My name is Bob Mason, and I'm looking forward to being with you this morning, and we're going to get to hear from a little bit later Helena Torres, who is a pharmacist. And what we're talking about today is caring for the whole person. Is that good medicine for patients and professionals? Jack knew that he was in trouble when he felt the shank of a blade go deep into his side. He was in a parking lot in Southern California. It was late at night, and nobody was around except he and some other guy who had attacked him. They struggled. Jack fell to the ground. He was robbed, and he was left for dead. We will come back to Jack's story a little bit later. A little bit about myself. I am married to Diana. I think she's somewhere here in this room, but we've been married for 34 years. We have two children, and those, any of you in pediatrics? Okay, a few. So don't report me to CPS, but you know that if you have kids, as long as you give them water every day and you feed them two or three times a week, they actually grow up. And these pictures were taken at Coronado Island, which is one of my favorite places on earth, across the bay from San Diego. So if you ever get out to Coronado, to San Diego, visit Coronado. This is a little bit more recent picture of my family. My son and his wife are on the far left. They're holding our three grandkids. They work with a faith-based organization, the same one that I work with, called Crew, and they serve on the Central Coast. My daughter is on the far right with her husband. Her husband is a pastor in Manhattan Beach, California, which is a suburb of L.A. My daughter is a nurse, and she was working at a hospital in Southern California in March of 2020 when admin walked on her floor and sort of waved their hands and said, "You guys are the COVID unit." And so she took care of COVID patients at the very beginning of the pandemic, back when they said, "We ain't got no PPE for you." And so she did that for 2.5 years. We are grateful and praise God that she never got sick during that time. Some of her colleagues did get sick. In fact, they lost one or two of them in the pandemic. But that's a little bit about me. And so I want to let you know, even though that we are at GMHC, I am going to be coming from a definite perspective today, and that is, Helena is too, and that is a Christian perspective. Now, I think that's okay for most people in this room, but if you're concerned about that, I want you to relax. I speak on secular campuses about this topic, and I'm not here to try to force my ideas on you or cram anything down your throat. Everybody here knows how to think critically, and what Helena and I are hoping is at the end of this time, you will be able to draw your own conclusions about the things that we talk about, and you get to decide whether you feel like this will be helpful to you or not. I don't have any disclosures, and back to Jack's story. I intersected Jack's life when I was training some med students to do whole person care and spiritual care at a major medical center, and we walked into Jack's room. And we introduce ourselves and we explain what we're doing in terms of this training exercise and trying to better understand how patients cope with faith and religion during illness. Asked if he'd be willing to talk and answer a few questions, and he did. And we began asking some spiritual history questions. Those are a set of questions that are designed to find out, what is a patient's coping system? Is faith a part of that coping system? Are there spiritual needs there? Is there coping system working well for them? Do they recognize those spiritual needs? Do they want to have those needs addressed, etc.? And as we walk through that spiritual history, what keeps you going? What's your source of strength? How has this changed the way you see yourself? And when we ask him the question, how has this affected the way that you think about God? Jack pulled out this huge Bible, and I'm not talking about the kind that the Gideons pass out on campus that fit in your pocket. I'm talking about a grandma Bible. You know, it's like that thick and that wide, and he heaves it up onto the table across, you know, his bed, and that thing goes thump, and he opens the Bible, and he starts giving us a tour through this Bible. His roommate at the hospital before he had been discharged gave this Bible to Jack, and he had started reading it. And he was touring us. It was like, here's where it talks about Adam and Eve, and over here it talks about King David. And back here it talks about this guy named Jesus. And in this section it talks about Jesus dying. And at that point I asked Jack, I said, Jack, why did Jesus have to die? And he's like, I don't know. And I said, would it be helpful to you if we talk about that? And he said, yes. And so using his own Bible, I flip over to John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. And we began unpacking that verse. And at one point in the conversation, Jack sits up in bed and he says, I know I am here in this hospital right now because I need to hear what you're telling me. And within a few minutes, Jack told us that he wanted that relationship with the Creator God made possible through Christ, and he put his trust in Christ. And a few days later, we came back and we visited with him. And do you remember us? And yes. Do you remember what we talked about? Yes. And he essentially walks us through the gospel again. Now, here's what I would like you to do. I would like you to turn in groups of two or three. And I would like you to talk about, as a healthcare professional, as a student in training, as somebody who's been around healthcare, maybe involved in healthcare missions, I'd like you to talk about that story. What did you like about that story? What did you not like? What concerns do you have and what questions do you have? Ready? Go. I'll give you about 2 minutes. So where we are going today, a couple of things. One, I am going to sort of introduce the concept of whole person care, and I'm going to cover a lot of ground, going to hit the high points. I'm not going to necessarily go real deep. And one of the questions that you probably were asking, and if you weren't asking, you should have been asking as you listen to that story, about this conversation within the context of a healthcare situation. Well, Bob, that sounds really cool sitting in the church here at GMHC, but that's not where I work. That's not where I live. That's not who is telling me what's right and what's wrong. And so what you're even talking about, is that even appropriate? Is it even ethical? Is it legal? Are you coercing the patient and taking its advantage of an unequal power situation? And see, that's what Helena's going to be talking about a little bit later. We're going to do a really deep dive into the question about the ethical basis of whole person care. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about just the real practical stuff. And for anybody watching online, I need to make a confession. The slides that are up online do not match what you have on your screen right now because I did something I rarely do, and that is I sort of completely rewrote my talk about 30 minutes ago. So we're going to struggle through this together. Really didn't rewrite it, just sort of reorganized and pulled in some other stuff. When it comes to broaching spiritual issues, when it comes to making a spiritual assessment with a patient, how do you even begin to do that? Well, it's done much in the same way that you do medical care. When a patient comes to you, they have a need, and your job is to figure out the need. And you ask a bunch of questions, history of present illness, family history, all that type of stuff. And a spiritual history is something very similar. It's, as I said earlier, trying to find out what is a patient's coping system and spiritual belief and is there any type of spiritual crisis. And here's some spiritual history questions that we've come up with. If you were to go to PubMed or Google Scholar and type in spiritual history, you'll be surprised at how many hits you get. These questions, some are borrowed from some of those other spiritual history forums that you might find online. The Joint Commission actually suggests and has historically required in the United States that spiritual assessments and spiritual care be done. And some of these questions come from their suggestions, and some of them are original to us. And so you can read, and I'll let you read those, but what I want to do right now is I want to give you an opportunity to sort of jump in really fast and practice a little bit. So why don't you get back with your partner, and if you didn't like your partner that you just talked to, you can get up and you can move to the other side of the room and find somebody else. But one of you can, and we'll only take a few minutes for this, one of you can assume the role of a patient and the other can be the healthcare professional. And practice, maybe get a little feel for asking these types of questions. Ready? I'll give you about 3 minutes. Go. So I'm going to do something a little dangerous. I'm going to open up the floor. And so what did you think of that? What concerns? What did you like? What concerns did you have? What questions did you have? Anybody dare to say anything? Yes, sir, in the back. I'm sorry? Okay.
And I think one of the challenges is when you get an answer that is very far from where your own faith is.
Yes, right.
What
do
you do with that?
Okay, and so you're talking with somebody that's coming from a different faith perspective.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that, I'm sorry, and so, okay, all right. Yeah, and so there are two questions there. And in terms of a different faith perspective, my view is that, and I don't want to pun on this, and I won't, I'll say more, but I think individually you're going to have to decide how you want to respond to that. And some of the options that you have is, one, you could, and especially if there's a spiritual need there or there's some spiritual questions, one of the ways that you can respond to that is you can say, you know, I am not familiar with that faith perspective or that is not my own tradition, and so I can't speak to that. Another way that you can respond to it is, and this is something you have to decide and you have to think about, and that is, do you want to facilitate connecting them with somebody from their faith perspective? Do you want to bring somebody in, a chaplain, like a Muslim chaplain or a referrer or something like that? Another thing that you can do is if there is a spiritual need there and they recognize that need and they're open to that, what you could say is, I am a Christ follower or I am a Christian. I could speak to that from a Christian perspective. Would that be helpful to you? And so I think recognizing patient autonomy is important. I think being true in maintaining your own personal integrity is important. And so there's some options there. And again, you have to think about that. So any other thoughts about those questions or about that, the taking a spiritual history or any thoughts on that? Yes, sir. Yes. Right. Yes.
But if you're part of Kaiser or some other system, it's hard.
Right. And one of the things that we're thinking about, I'm spending a lot more time thinking about, and that is the whole time constraint. I think that is huge. That is where you live. And I don't know if it's going to be any better overseas when you go to work on the mission field, and you've got a line of people that like stretches out the door 100 yards. I don't totally presume to know how to work through all of that. I think one of the things, and Helena's going to talk about this, is spiritual care beneficial to the patient? And I think she's going to argue that it is, and it could impact outcomes. And it could be beneficial not only to the patient spiritually and personally, but in terms of their physical overall well-being. In terms of the time constraints, that's a whole nother talk, and I'm hoping to, we're hoping to get some things online. I'm going to speak to that just a little bit later. Yes?
There are certain healthcare systems and hospitals that would identify a certain worldview as oppressive. to use some of the local cultural language now.
Yes.
How do you deal with that if you're in that kind of system?
Again, I think it goes back to, is this something that would be beneficial to the patient? I think recognizing patient autonomy in terms of what they desire and what they would prefer are factors to that. The other thing, you know, sometimes what happens between a physician and a patient in a room that's closed, that's between them. I think as a healthcare professional, you do have some discretion in terms of how you're going to care for your patients. That is a challenge, but I know people who are doing spiritual care in the United States in a variety of healthcare settings, a variety of perspectives, variety of administrations, and they have figured out a way to do that. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just thought that I just reflected on an experience. You know, it depends on the patient population, but there was some salient moments that calls for this particular approach, especially times either you just notice a patient is experiencing troubles or distress, that is also an opportunity to take advantage of, or certain moments that feels like you are relaxed at work and it's not so much demanding, and then you can take advantage of such moments, or you just notice a patient is just by himself or not being attended to. Those are opportunities. I'm talking from a nursing perspective.
Okay.
And so I saw that it was helpful with an elderly person who, after a few days, died. So I took that opportunity and just talked with the person. But my colleague was like, what are you doing? You know, just being there with the patient.
Sure.
So you'll be challenged when you are trying to attend to patients' spiritual needs by other colleagues as well. So that's also another challenge.
Yeah.
You would face.
Yeah, the physician who started the organization I work with, Medical Strategic Network, referred to that last part that you mentioned about what your colleagues think, and he called that the fear of the sneer of the peer. I'm convinced that everybody's on a spiritual journey, and they are at different points in their spiritual journey. And we have the Engel scale, if you're familiar with that. It's got a lot more points and a lot more specificity. I'm not smart enough to keep up with all those categories. And so I think people are on this spiritual journey somewhere from having no interest in God to searching to being receptive to being well on their way as a Christ follower. I think you see something similar to that spiritual journey unpacked in Acts chapter 10. It's a story of Peter and Cornelius. And a lot of times, I think we, in a conversation like this, we look at Cornelius, and that he was a Roman centurion, and he was on a spiritual journey. In fact, he was warm towards God, and he was receptive towards God, and he was trying to be pleasing to God to the degree that he was somewhat listening. And God said, hey, you need to send some of your guys, because there's a guy named Peter up the road, and you need to go have Peter brought to you because he has something I want you to hear. And so what does Cornelius do? He sends these guys up to find this guy named Peter, whom they've never met or whom they've never seen. But they got some idea of where he's at. Interestingly enough, there's another journey that Peter's on. He is more on that area of a Christ follower scale, mature Christian. But in his journey at that point, and his faith community has some values that mean that there's certain things you don't do. And there's certain people that you don't hang out with, let alone talk to, about anything. But then God, in a way I won't unpack, begins to work with Peter in the end, that attitude and that willingness to connect. And so Peter is sort of struggling with this idea and this concept, and then these guys show up at his doorstep, and they're from this group of people that Peter thinks you don't hang out with. But God does something in his heart and changes him and makes him willing to go and talk to these people. And it's real interesting when he does start to leave, they tell him, they're ready to hear what you have to say. Do you remember Jack laying in that hospital bed? I know. I am here in this room right now because I need to hear what you have to say. Men and women, I am absolutely convinced if you work in healthcare and you are willing to take spiritual histories, you will intersect people like Jack and you will intersect people like Cornelius. But the question is, are you being willing to be responsive like Peter was in his journey? Sort of change things up, being willing to take a step of faith, being willing to maybe risk some things, whether it's ridicule, whether it's misunderstanding, whether it's maybe even being challenged by administration. And we're not going to leave you hanging out on the line. That's what Helena is going to talk about. But I think that's, in a talk like this, it's really important that we at least acknowledge that this is a struggle. And it's not always easy to lean into God and lean into work and lean into mission in this manner. And I get that. And I've been there. And I've dealt with the fear, the sneer, the peer. I train residents to do spiritual care. And there have been times in recent months that I haven't been willing to ask another question because, well, I don't know that resident. What are they going to think? Or I don't know. Gosh, can you believe? I don't know what this med student's going to think. Why should I be concerned about what a med student thinks? But I am. All right? David Levy, some of you know David, know this story, found himself in a dental chair and he had a cavity and he was going to have it filled. And the dentist, who was a person of faith, was trying to sneak up on him with that syringe or whatever it is, you guys, you know, give him that injection in his mouth. And David says that when it comes to injections, he feels it is much more blessed to give than to receive. So with an attitude like that, there was some apprehension, there's some tension, and I think the dentist picked up on that and said, Dr. Levy, before we continue this procedure, would it be helpful if I pray for you? And it's like, sure. So he prays for him, and he gives him the shot, and he feels his teeth, and David's on his way home, and he sort of has this God conversation. And it's like, so what did you think of the dentist? Yeah, nice guy. What did do a good job on his tooth? Yeah. You think you'll go back? Yeah. So what did you think about him praying for you? Well, that was nice. Why don't you do that with your patients? Well, gee, God, everybody knows that neurosurgeons don't pray with their patients. I mean, what would they think? That I'm scared? That I'm not confident in my ability? No, it's out of the question. Well, that conversation persisted after he got home in the coming weeks. And there would be times when Dr. Levy was on his way to work, he'd say, yeah, I'll offer to pray with my patient. Well, he get to the end of the day, he didn't. So finally he woke up one day, I will not leave the hospital till I offer, and got there and he had his victim picked out. It was a lady he was going to be doing a procedure on, and his plan was during the pre-op visit, after the nurse left, he would offer to pray. He goes in, he does a pre-op visit, the nurse is there, the patient's there, her adult daughter is there, and he's waiting for the nurse to leave. He's done everything medically, and the nurse doesn't leave, and he stalls, and nurse doesn't leave, and he stalls some more, and nurse doesn't leave, and they're like, why are you still here? So he leaves, and nurse's station, he's acting like he's on the phone, and he's not, reading text, and he's not, he's waiting for the nurse to leave, nurse leaves. Starts down the hall, the anesthesiologist is coming. He does an about face because there's no way he's doing this in front of the anesthesiologist. Anesthesiologist leaves. He swoops into the room. He mutters something about praying. And the patient and, the mom, or the patient and the daughter is like, yeah, okay. And so he prays. And at the end of the prayer, these ladies are crying with tears of appreciation. And it's like, I created this mess. And he says he did what he always does when he creates a mess. And he leaves so that the nurses can clean it up. At that point in David's practice, he had done some phenomenal surgeries. I think at that time he had maybe even been invited overseas and done a procedure in Europe. And in his home with some med students and other students last summer, or a year ago summer, he told us, I got more joy out of that procedure that day than I had at any other case I'd done so far. He goes in to tell the daughter about the good outcome, and she's like, Dr. Levy, thank you for praying. You have no idea what that meant to my mom and me. And so he started doing that more often. One time he was doing it, and a nurse came up to him and said, Dr. Levy, can I talk to you? Yeah. Some of us have been watching you and have seen what you've been doing with patients. It's like, oh, no, here it comes. We think that's really cool. Would you be willing to invite us in when you do that? David wrote a book entitled Gray Matter, Neurosurgeon Discovers Power Prayer One Patient at a Time. I'd encourage you to get it. So how is whole person care, spiritual care done? If I came to you and I presented in your ED or your clinic and I complain about a pain in my side, what are you going to do? You're going to work me up. You're going to physical exam, maybe some imaging, some blood work. Come up with the diagnosis. You're going to come in. You're going to sit down. You're going to talk to me about your treatment plan, which is surgery. And then, of course, what do you need from me? Consent. Patient autonomy, right? And I look at you and I say, Doc, I ain't having nobody cut on me. Do I have a need? Do I have a medical need? Yes. Do I recognize that medical need? Apparently not. And I don't know about Kentucky, but where I'm from in California, if I'm a sane, competent adult, and there are people who know me well that dispute whether I'm a sane, competent adult, but if I am, you can't strap me down and yank out my appendix. Now, during that visit, if you start looking at my foot, and I hear you mutter something about amputation week at the med center, and then I hear you say something about complaining about not getting your quota, what do you call that? You're like, what the heck? You would call that malpractice. Why? Because there's nothing wrong with my foot. There's nothing indicated that my foot has anything to do with the pain in my side. I don't need you creating medical needs that I don't have. Same thing with spiritual care. Within the context of healthcare, spiritual care is done in the same way. In response to a patient need, that the patient recognizes that need, that the patient wants to have addressed, and done so with permission, with consent. You follow that, that will keep you out of trouble most of the time. A lot of times when friends I've known have been challenged or been questioned, it's because there's been a misunderstanding. People have caught part of the conversation and assumed everything that happened before, which wasn't correct at all. Now, I'm not guaranteeing that you won't be challenged. I'm not guaranteeing that you might sort of endure the sneer of the peer or be subject to that. But most people end up coming out unscathed when things come out in the open and there's explanation. And you follow autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, justice. Helena's going to talk more about that. You approach your patients with sensitivity and permission and respect. Well, what are some spiritual interventions that are most common? People are always afraid that they're going to want to know about the eschatological position of the premillennial, progressive socialist. That's not what patients want to talk about, usually. Most of the time, they need encouragement. If they're a Christ follower or they're warm to faith, one of the things that I often quote to them is what Jesus said. Matthew, come to me, all who are labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon me. upon you and learn from me. I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. You're already doing everything you can for them physically, medically. The spiritual is a soul issue. They need some rest. I can't provide that. You can't provide that. Jesus can. God can. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Another very common intervention, probably the most common intervention, is prayer. Doesn't have to be eloquent, doesn't have to be long, doesn't have to be, well, what do I pray for? Well, maybe things you already know about the patient, maybe about their decision, about a treatment, maybe about the pain that they're having, maybe about they're concerned about being in the hospital because nobody is around to feed their pets. Maybe it's their bill. Maybe it's how am I going to get home when I'm discharged tomorrow. And you just don't blurt into prayer. You ask him. How do you ask him? I don't know if you caught that phrase earlier. Would it be helpful? Would it be helpful to you? What if I say, can I pray for you? Nothing necessarily wrong with saying, can I pray for you? But that's a little bit different than would it be helpful, you see? Focus. Can I? I've seen people, I've seen students say, well, can I pray for you? And patients respond, well, if you want to. If that's something you want to do, that's not the question. Would it be helpful to you? Also, if I say, would it be helpful to you, that's sort of a little bit of a defense if I'm challenged. You know? Patient-centered. Another spiritual journey. And people are at different places, and the questions, the way they answer those questions will begin to give you some idea of where they're at. And what do you do when you intersect the life of somebody or a patient who's searching and maybe even receptive? Would you say Jack was receptive? Would you say he was searching? I mean, it's pretty clear when somebody like heaves his like 5-pound, 10-pound Bible, you know, and not that's like rare. That's like a primo story. A lot of times it's like, so how has this illness affected the way you think about God? One guy told me he said, you know, I was hurt, accident, worksite accident, and been praying a lot more. I was like, oh, how's that going for you? Well, I feel really guilty about praying. I'm like, really? Why? And he said, well, you know, a week ago everything was fine. I wasn't thinking about God. And all of a sudden I'm hurt and I'm like calling out. That's not good. You know? And God brought this verse to my mind, Romans 5:8, and while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. I did a little paraphrase. I'm not sure if it totally lines up with the Greek, but I said, call this guy Steve. I said, it says in the Bible that before we were thinking about God, God was thinking about us. It says that in the Bible? Yeah. And I said, so that you are praying to God? I think he's pretty excited about that. Really? Yeah. Other times, I remember a patient we were talking to, it sounds like you're sort of like reconsidering things about God and faith and sort of wanting to reach out. Is that what I hear you saying? Yeah, that's exactly where I am. It says patient, lady patient in California. Not Alabama or Texas where everybody's a Christian. Right? And so what do you do with that patient? One of the things that you might consider doing is something like this. Many patients say they want to know God better. Would you say that's true of you? Sort of what I was asking that lady. I don't ask these questions to manipulate the conversation or to steer the conversation. These are truly diagnostic questions. And I don't care on one level how they respond. If they say no, I'm fine with that. I respect that. I'm not going to press in. But many patients will say yes. Especially if you sort of done a good job trying to get some general assessment of where they're at. And again, this isn't with every patient. This isn't every day. You don't get to do an appendectomy every day. But when you have that need, you're available to do that or refer for that. You respond to where they're at. Well, when patients tell me they'd like to know God better, I sometimes take a few minutes for them to explain from a Christian perspective how one can connect with God in a more meaningful way. It takes about 10 minutes. Anybody have any idea what I'm trying to do here? What am I trying to set the patient up for? You remember? You do that. You do this at work. You try to set them up for what? Consent? But what type of consent? Informed consent. You see that? Because, see, I tell them this, and then I ask them this. Would it be helpful to you to read through or talk more about this? And again, this isn't a manipulative steering question. This is a diagnostic question. You see what I'm saying? See where I'm coming from? Back to, where is it? There. Setting them up for informed consent. I'm doing a normalizing statement. Tell them that I'm available to talk for, try to give them a time frame. And I try to let them know what perspective I'm coming from. Christian perspective. Not Islam, not Buddhist, not secular, Christian. And then, where'd it go? Would it be helpful to you? And if they say yes, I say, now before we start this conversation, I want you to know if you get tired or you get uncomfortable or you want to stop this conversation at any time, you just let me know. Again, what am I doing? Affirming their autonomy. And during the conversation, I will often ask them again, you doing okay? You want to keep going? You getting tired? And at any point, same thing you do on a procedure. Now, if it hurts too much, you let me know, and we'll take a break, or we'll give you some more meds, or we'll pull you out. You know, same thing. Now, here's where it might get interesting. We were having some trouble with this. I want to show a video. It's about 5-6 minutes about a conversation like we just talked about. Now, pray it works. I'm going to try a couple of things. There it goes. Good. Yay.
So I have been using this tool a lot in my sphere of influence at work, coworkers, patients, neighbors. I really like it just because it's simple and clear. So a few months ago, I got a report that one of my patients was in a car accident and paralyzed from the waist down, and that's all I really knew. And then when I was looking further into the notes, I could see that it was a suicide attempt. So when I went into the room, I could just tell that this man was really soft-hearted and pretty remorseful about the whole situation. And so I was asking the Lord, like, how do you want me to enter into conversation with this man? God, would you give me wisdom? Help me to be sensitive to what he needs. And also bold in sharing hope with him. And so when I went into the room, I asked him, so I know that you were in a car accident, but could you tell me a little bit more about what happened? Do you remember? And he said, yeah, and he was very open with me and told me that he basically tried to drive himself into a tree and wanted to end his life, and just shared with everything else that was going on in his life beforehand. And so then I asked him, well, when you drove yourself into the tree, what did you think was going to happen after? What do you think was going to happen when you died? And he said, I don't really know. Like, I'd like to believe that there's a heaven and that I'd be good enough for it, but I don't really know. And then he asked me what I thought. And so I got to just share with him like a 15-second testimony, and we were chatting about faith. And then I asked him, could I just draw you a picture that would help explain everything that we're talking about in a really clear and simple way? And he said, yeah. And I didn't have any paper with me, but I was wearing gloves. So I drew this picture, my gloves. And I'm just going to share it with you as I was sharing it with him. And So I said, hey, everyone in this world probably could agree that we live in a really broken place. You just turn on the TV, you look at social media, there's brokenness all over the place. So just trying to represent that here. But this is not the way that God intended it to be when he first created the world. So when he first created it, it was perfect. There was no pain and suffering. There was no brokenness. We had everything we needed. But starting with the very first humans, we chose to leave God's original design to go with brokenness. We departed. Thought we could do it on our own. This is what the Bible calls sin. But the thing with brokenness is we don't like to stay here. So we'll try all sorts of things to get out. This might look different for all people. It might look like climbing a ladder of success and work in school, making a lot of money, being successful. Some people might turn to a relationship to try to find life in another broken person. Some people might do a lot of good things, be a good person, read their Bible, go to church, and even though those are good things, they are never enough. You never get somebody out of brokenness. And some people might experience so much pain and suffering that they might just do things to numb it out, like you have drugs, alcohol, and even attempts of suicide. And when I said that, he just started to weep. And so the thing with these attempts to get out is they're like a rubber band. They can only stretch so far before it was snapped right back into reality that we live in a broken world and there's nothing that we can ever do on our own strength to get ourselves out of brokenness. And so that's bad news, but God loved you so much that he didn't want you to stay here. He still wanted a relationship with you, even though you went your own way. And we all did. So he did for us what we could never do for ourselves. He made a little door out of this broken world through his son, Jesus. So Jesus came down. He left his perfect place, came down, came near to us. And then he paid the price for our sin, forgiving us, canceling our sin. And then 3 days later, he rose again, proving to the world that this God really was God, and he really did love us, and he did all of this so that we could be restored back into relationship with him and be made new. And all we would have to do is turn from our ways of trying to get out of brokenness. They rip us off, rob us of joy, they never work, and surrender. Surrender and trust in Jesus, that he really did come, he came, he forgave you, making him the king and lord of your life. So everyone in this world can find themselves in one of two places, either here in relationship with God or here in brokenness. And then I asked him, where are you? And he said, I'm in brokenness. And I said, well, where do you want to be? And he said, I want to be in relationship with God. And then I asked him what was holding me back. And he said, nothing really. I feel like this is a second chance. And so then I asked him if he wanted to open the door of his heart to the Lord and be made new, be restored in relationship with God. And he said, yes. And so we got to pray together. And yeah, he was just in tears. It was just really cool to see somebody pass from spiritual death to spiritual life. And, he told me, I had him the next few days too, and he told me that he called his wife and he shared the gospel with her. And they were just so excited to have new life in God, even though his physical circumstances didn't change. He was made new.
That wasn't at a faith-based hospital. That wasn't in the South. Nicole wasn't working at a place that had a cross hanging on the wall. So there's opportunity. Burnout's huge. Southern Medical Journal wrote this long ago, and I think it's more true today than it was in 2004, where they said that caring about the patient is what gives joy and fulfillment to the practice of medicine. It's why many of you chose this profession. Its absence, especially in pressured healthcare environment, can rapidly lead to dissatisfaction, emotional exhaustion, and burnout. Practicing whole person medicine is the best kind of care, both for those who receive it and those who give it. It can be life-giving, not only to your patients, but to you. I've been training healthcare professionals, and I have a team. I'm blessed with a team of healthcare professionals that work with me in this. And Bill Griffin and I were talking about this yesterday. How do you do this? I mean, we can do the technique, but I'm honestly convinced it's not that much about technique or answering all the questions. It really comes back to your heart and your intentionality. I'm becoming more convinced of this, and I've had the privilege of being a part of a team that's trained thousands around the world. And the people I see doing it are the ones who are responsive, like Peter was. Okay, I'll go talk to these people that my tribe says I never talk to. There's also an intentionality. Sarah Ongstad attended our whole person care preceptorship in California before, while she was in med school, and I caught up with Sarah recently. She's a vascular surgeon in the Midwest, again, not working at a faith-based facility, and dealing with the time issues and the constraints and the demands and the pressure and all that, and she consistently does spiritual care. And I said, Sarah, how do you do it? And she told me about a prayer that she prays every day. And I started calling it the SO prayer, Sarah Ongstad prayer, and it goes like this. She said, Bob, I pray this prayer every day when I'm driving to work. Help me to see, God, help me to see what you want me to see, hear what you want me to hear, do what you want me to do, and catch this. This is where I live. I don't live in the front part. I live in the back part. I don't know about you, this part. Even when it is hard, even when it hurts, even when I do not want to do it. And then she told me, she said, Bob, I pray that prayer not only on the way to work, but I pray that prayer several times throughout the day. Heart and intentionality. Chest, a few years ago, said we need more training in this area. And 2 hours is not enough, even though I just said training is not where it's at. There are a number of training options. CMDA has online faith prescriptions. Is that right, Bill? Bill's in the back. Raise your hand, Bill. You can talk to him afterwards about accessing that. There's a clinic in Phoenix called Neighborhood Christian Clinic. They've got an entire curriculum online available to anybody. There's a summer program called SMI, Summer Medical Institute. They're here, I think, hanging out at the CCHF booth, so you can talk to them, students. We do something called the Whole Person Care Preceptorship in Southern California. It's probably the best thing that we do. It's held from mid-June to mid-July every year. This will be the 23rd year that we've done it coming up. We've had students come from some of the best health science campuses in the world. We try to create an optimal spiritual greenhouse because a lot of times students sort of come in beat up and depleted. It's not like they've sort of left God on the side or forsaken God, but the pressure and the rigors of training just sort of squeeze, and come in spiritually depleted, emotionally, academically. So we try to provide an environment of refreshment. There are didactics. We do training on spiritual care. We have your shadowing clinicians who are doing spiritual care on an ongoing basis. We have a connection with Loma Linda Adventist Institution. We're non-denominational. And that gives us opportunity to take students in, to have conversations with patients like Jack. We have a connection or a partnership with SIM where students can attend the preceptorship and then go in. When they're done with the preceptorship, work in some SIM hospitals overseas in Africa. And we have fun. We're in Southern California, so we might go to the beach or a concert at the Hollywood Bowl. One group ended up at the Grand Canyon 1 year. I don't know how they got there, but they did. Everything in healthcare is about outcomes. And this might speak to, well, I'm in an oppressive situation, and I don't mean to, and I get that. Some of our alumni, a little bit about what they're doing from the preceptorship. About a year ago, unsolicited, Bruce Sabbath had attended the preceptorship when he was a med student at Johns Hopkins, not exactly the Liberty University of the Northeast. But he is now a pulmonologist at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. I think heavily Jewish influenced institution, or a lot of Jewish faculty there. Bruce told me, he said, what you're doing in teaching spiritual care in medical context changed how I practiced medicine for all of my career. You hear some heart there. You hear some intentionality. The Lord has brought me to patients' lives often more, get this, for the spiritual than the physical. I could tell a lot of stories. Even if you're not interested in the preceptorship, I hope that statement's encouraging to you. I hope that statement's maybe challenging to some of you. Erica Erlander is here at the conference, attended the preceptorship. She is at a nurse at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. She was doing spiritual care one day, and her supervisor, "What are you doing?" Erica answered her, gave her a good answer as to why. And her supervisor said, "Would you be willing to do an in-service for everybody on our unit on spiritual care?" It can be done. Heart, intentionality, the Sarah Ongstead prayer, a little bit of training. So there's my contact info. We're going to take a break, like a 3-4 minute break. Helena's going to come up, change. So don't leave the room. You can talk among yourselves, and we'll try to have a Q&A at the end. Okay? All right. So, Dr. Torres, I do have information about the preceptorship if you want. We've got a booth. Stick by. Drop by. Thank you. You don't need that. Thank you, God. Hey! I didn't know you were here.
I am.
Good to see you.
Yeah, great talk.
We should have you do it.
No, I brought one of my friends. We're going to switch out. I know, I used your PowerPoint last time I got it.
It's yours as well.
What's this one?
I think that's for the
that?
The recording, and maybe for that, I don't know.
Okay.
They're recording it as well.
Okay. You did great. You're hard to follow, Bob.
What?
I said you're hard to follow.
I gave you the opportunity. No, they want to hear you first. They want to hear how.
This is not working with my hair. It's plugged in, but it's not coming up.
Interesting. Oh, okay. Okay, do you know how to do extend or
duplicate? So I have that, but it's not detecting that as a screen.
I have no idea what to do. You have other ports you can put it into, other USB?
I have USB ones, but this isn't
USB. Another USB-C port?
No.
On your computer?
I think I just have that one.
Okay. A couple of things. I have no idea. I'm thinking maybe save it.
Okay, I can send it. Do you want me to send it to you and use yours? Okay.
Let me get that in for you. Of course, I'm not sure if it's picking up this reader.
Yeah, I think that's what the issue is. But, yeah, I can just save it to that. That's fine.
Okay. Is it picking up the thumb drive?
Yes.
Center view here.
Yeah.
But you got that just up on the screen. It's the right.
Yeah. It's just, it's not showing the right one as the next slide. That's why I was confused. But it's fine. It doesn't matter.
Oh, it's not showing your notes?
It's not showing the next slide. So, like, the next slide is a different one. So.
Oh.
Oh, or maybe, it, like, that picture. It's fine. I got it.
Oh, wait. Okay. So, you want the clicker?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
All right. Is this on?
Okay, so we probably need to save this to my computer. You can just do it like there.
Yeah. Will the clicker not work if I...
Because it's, I got to have a thumb drive plugged in.
Oh.
And my only thing is right there.
Okay. I can click on the computer. It's not a big deal.
Not a big deal?
Nope.
Okay.
All right. Is this on?
Should be.
Okay.
So you got both of them on?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I don't know if they can hear me, though.
You good?
I think. All right.
Is it coming over?
I don't hear it, but it might be just because of the loud.
Let me see. I don't know. Pull it back out. I don't think I turned it off, or I don't think I muted it. Push that mute button. Now try it.
All right, we're gonna. All right. And they might have. All right, we'll see when we get started. I can adjust it a little bit.
Okay, you want me to get them settled down?
So this was
oh.
Interesting to try to get this set up here.
I want my computer back now.
No. if you can't tell, Bob and I have been really good friends for years, so I will make fun of him relentlessly during this, but I'll try to be nice. I'll jump in since I want to make sure that I can get through all the things that you guys want to hear. So Bob has got you all jazzed to go in and to do spiritual care with your patients, and the understanding of who we are as Christians and our obligation to the gospel drives us, motivates us, is who we are, and is what we want to do. But also, we don't want to get fired because we got bills to pay. So let's talk about how do we do this in a secular setting? How do we do this even in a Christian setting? And how do we do it in a way that's ethical? How do we do it in a way where, yes, like Bob said, there might be sneers, but like we are ready with a defense for the hope that we have. Amen. So we're going to talk about that. I'm going to pray because there's a lot of y'all. And I'm facing the camera. And I'm a little awkward. So we're just going to pray and allow the Holy Spirit to do what he does. So, all right. Well, Lord, I thank you for this group of people. I thank you that they are gathered here and they are hungry to see how they can serve you more with the people in whose lives that you've put them, how they can use every encounter, every moment to serve and to glorify you and to focus their eyes on the kingdom and to share the hope that is within them and to share the life that you've given them. I pray that as I speak today, Lord, that you would empty me, that it would be you, that you would speak to hearts who are ready to receive you, that you would commit to memory the things that are important, and anything that I say that is wrong or just a mess, you can get rid of that. And I pray that you would humbly use me here on the stage through conversations this weekend and in each and every moment that you allow me to serve you. And I pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. So like Bob said, I am a pharmacist. I've been a pharmacist for about 12 years now, somewhere around there. I stopped losing count after a while and just say a lot. So I've been serving as a pharmacist. I also recently, the Lord led me to go back to school. I know it was the Lord because I can barely make it through a CE, let alone another graduate program. So I am also finishing up a master's in counseling. And so have ambitions to be an LPC here sooner rather than later. And so that puts me in two positions, one where people just want me to pass out drugs like candy and not talk to me at all, and the other one where they pay me to talk to me. And so I kind of have both aspects there. I either have no time to talk or I have all the time in the world to talk. And so I'll kind of talk from both perspectives in that. My first person. I hate the word client. That's what we're supposed to use in the counseling realm. I hate that. And so I just say the people. These are my people that God has given me. So my first person, one of the first things she asked me was, say something, tell me something about yourself and make you human to me. And so I'll do that. I'll start there. So like I said, I'm a pharmacist, also an LPCC, which is just means I'm a fake counselor until I graduate. I live in South Dakota. I saw some South Dakota people. We will talk. what else about me? So this is my family. This was taken over the summer. We vacationed to Minnesota. I dragged them into the woods. Bless their souls. This is also my family. It didn't come to the front. Okay. That did not go out the way that I was supposed to. So I'm going to escape for a second so you guys can see what I actually wanted you to see. Bob, where's the clicker? Nope. Not seeing.
Pull it all the way to the right or left, and it should come into your screen.
Aha! Okay. So this is my... Nope. Where did my duplicate... It does not like me right now. It does not want y'all to see the pictures. Okay, so I'm going to go back to the slideshow. All right. Okay, so it didn't work the way you're supposed to. These nice little clicks back here show a bunch of different pictures of my family. And what you will see is that none of them have the same children in them. There's a reason for that. I'm a foster parent. And so my family is going to look different months of the year, different years. So right now I have four teenagers living with me. If you would have talked to me this time last year, I had two babies. I was losing my mind. I was like, how do we do this without being like an eight-armed octopus? And so I've been fostering for about 8 years as well. And so my family looks different all the time. And I love that. And I love each and every child that, and each and every family, because it's really the family that I desire to minister to, that God has brought into my life. And so my foreign teens are at home enjoying a day off of school and ghosting me and not texting me back. So, yeah, y'all should fix that. So, let's get into it. Is it ethical? So we talked about, again, that desire, how to do spiritual care. But the question you guys want to know, is it ethical? So let's start off with a definition of ethics. So according to the rules and standards of the profession and pertaining to right and wrong in conduct. So right doesn't always follow according to the rules. Can we agree on that? Most of us would agree that as Christians in spiritual care, it's right. Like, it's what we should do. But we're not always sure if it follows the rules. What about gray areas? So spiritual care can be very ethical, or it can be unethical. And so we're going to kind of talk about what ethical practice of spiritual care looks like, and also what unethical practice of spiritual care looks like. All right, so this one's a little bit busy. I'm not a slide reader, so y'all have these, and you should be able to read through a lot of the points. So I'm going to try to hit some of the highlights. So spiritual care involves identifying and addressing spiritual aspects of a person's worldview and how this affects their well-being. What do you not hear me say spiritual care is in there? That's not a reflective question. I want actual answers. Christian.
It's not evangelism.
It's not evangelism. What else isn't it?
Religion.
It's not a religion. It's not a checklist of I prayed with the patient. I did spiritual care. So spiritual care is identifying and addressing the spiritual aspects of a patient's worldview. So ethical codes. The AMA ethical code states that physicians should have considerable latitude to practice in accordance with the well-considered, deeply held beliefs that are central to their self-identities. ANA code of ethics. So for my nurses in the room, so the nurses will practice with compassion and respect for the dignity, worth, and unique aspects of every person. And they kind of define those a little bit more down in that code, provision one that says the emotional, social, religious, or spiritual well-being. So the main tenets that we usually talk about when we talk about ethics are beneficence, non-maleficence, autonomy, and justice. And we will break those down ad nauseum the rest of this talk. So I'm just going to kind of preview here what we're going to talk about later on. But I want you to keep those tenets in mind as we're talking through this talk. So, Christian perspective, because that's the worldview that we're coming from. God calls each of us to a specific vocation, and our contributions to that vocation can be holy and can be a place and a platform for personal ministry and evangelism and discipleship. So, God calls us to this profession for a reason. It's not just this pays your bills, and then you go home or you go to church, and that's your ministry over here, and never shall the two meet. That is not what God calls us to. God calls the whole person, and he desires to utilize every aspect of our lives for his glory. All right, let's talk about Joe. So Joe is a 50-year-old tall man. Everybody's tall to me, but I think he's tall to the general population, with a large frame, and he has lung cancer and metastatic to the liver. Several trips to the cancer center, he appeared extremely weak and needing assistance at home. At home, he was having difficulty accepting help with his activities of daily living, bathing, dressing, toileting, eating, all the things, from even his wife or family. He continues to refuse assistance despite near falls. The medical team is concerned for his safety, and he's recommended physical therapy, occupational therapy multiple times, but he repeatedly declines this offer. So we're going to keep talking about Joe as we go through here. So we've got our background of Joe. Keep Joe in mind because Joe's your patient as we talk through this. So let's back up a little bit. Spirituality has played a role in healthcare for centuries. This is not a new thing. And so scientific focus has moved the culture of medicine away from that actual from holistic, service-oriented to a technologically sound system. And there's now a movement to reclaim the spiritual roots of medicine.
So we moved from like this kind of spiritual healing model that kind of started out what medicine, the original basis of medicine. Technology moved us to this medical model. In the medical model, what's the central idea? What are we focused on in the medical model? I heard cure, physical, yeah. What else? What outcomes? We're focused on a problem, disease. So we're focused on the people's. We're not focused on a person. We're focused on their problem. So this is a diabetic. This is a cardiac case. This is this. So the medical model seeks to solve a problem. Versus the wellness model, which is what we're trying to actually move back to, which focuses on the whole person and their livelihood and their worthiness, versus just let's fix this specific problem. So we talked about the code of ethics now. The 1847 code of ethics actually said the physician should be a minister of hope and comfort to the sick. It said, it's therefore a sacred duty to guard himself carefully in this respect and to avoid all things which have the tendency to discourage the patient and to depress his spirits. And the preamble said, it must rest on the basis of religion and morality. Does that sound the same as the code of ethics that I quoted a couple slides ago? No. So spiritual care isn't modern. It's not something new. It's actually a return to the old and original purpose of medicine. Think of the differences in today's ethical code to what was almost 200 years ago and which one lines up for today. All right, so whole person perspective. Bob kind of talked about this. Body, soul, spirit, social relations. So our body can tell us things like chronic pain, hypertension, but then we also have the aspects of the person that are their soul and their spirit and their social relations, and we want to make sure that we're keeping all of those things in mind when we're assessing patients. So let's go back to Joel. Keeping the whole person's perspective in mind, take a couple minutes, the people around you, what would you like to know about Joe's social situation? So discuss your questions for a minute or two with people around you, and then I'll ask for questions. I'm not as good at that as Bob is. What do we want to know about Joe? What are some questions that we have about Joe's social situation? Let's focus on just the social part.
Occupation.
His occupation?
What's his relationship with his family?
Relationship with his family? Any other questions that we have?
What's he afraid of?
What's he afraid of?
What
to do for a living? Let's see. So, he's a professional writer. He says, my pen has taken me out of projects, given me control of my circumstances from a very young age, and it helped me get through COVID without a cough. Death is as much a reality as birth, growth, maturity, and old age. It is my only certainty of life. Yes, you guessed it. I wrote that in my will yesterday. I hate to brag, but I'm quite proud of that line. He's been married for 25 years. He has no children, and he lives in Los Angeles. So what do you notice in that? What does he value? What do we hear he values from that?
Control.
Independence. What gives him meaning? Yeah. So his writing, how good he is. That he did it himself. Yes. So was that one of those spiritual questions that Bob asked? What does it tell you about his spiritual? What does it tell you spiritually about him? Yeah, so we hear a lot of self-reliance there. What else? Go ahead.
He's a creator.
So he values creation. We can use that. So even asking, what do you do for a living, gave us a clue to where he was spiritually. So his social-emotional situation, can give you a clue to their spiritual condition. So, the greatest mistake in the treatment of diseases is that there are physicians for the, it's closed, covered up by his Plato's picture, physicians for the body and physicians for the soul, although the two cannot be separated. So even Plato saw the connection. If they cannot be separated, then we must care for both. So, you ought not to attempt to cure the eyes without the head, or the head without the body. So neither are you to attempt to cure the body without the soul. For the part can never be well unless the whole is well. So, can we agree that some physical diseases are spiritually based? So we see it in Psalms and Proverbs. Psalm 32, I refuse to confess my sin, my body wasted away, and I groan all the day long. And a tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. So broken relationship with God, broken relationship with others, broken relationships with self generally results in brokenness, broken relationship with our bodies. All right, what else do we want to know about Job? Brings him joy?
What's his relationship to his wife?
It's his relationship to his wife. What do we want to know about the spiritual aspects of Job?
Future expectations.
Future expectations.
Does he have a faith background?
Does he have a faith background? How can we transition that from what he's told us? From what we just heard? Any other ways that somebody would transition?
How does he cope with his stress?
How does he cope with his stress?
Does anything make meaning to you?
Yeah.
Being so independent to being dependent, how does he feel about that?
Yeah. So great transitions. So, spiritual aspects of Job. He's an atheist, currently practicing no religion. Born a Presbyterian, he says. There's no life beyond this one. He's been feeling less human with his physical decline. So that's kind of how he sees himself. And he has deep pride in his quality of life and independence. And he values being a master of his surroundings and himself. So what issues do we see in that? And how would you address them? So discuss that with your partner here for a second. And then we'll come back. I want to hear some of your thoughts. All right. What did we see? First question, what issues did you see?
Not searching.
What else?
I think he's been hurt.
Been hurt? You can hear a lot of hurt in there. What else do we see? Right. So he identifies, he knows where his self-worth is, and that is not existent right now for him.
He views disability as less than or not human.
Yeah. What else?
Born into a faith. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Right.
Yeah. He identifies as an atheist, not an agnostic, so I think that's a pretty strong decision that he made.
Yeah. So what? Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say it's not written there, but it's leading to, you know, have your view on not being there's no God, has that changed now that you're near the end?
Yeah. So that kind of leads us into how would you address it? Where would you go next with him?
Ask him if he finds that comforting.
What else? How else could we address it with him?
Have you ever had to deal with?
God exists, why am I in this condition? And so, the, you know, looking into that much more closely. Probably there are certain aspects of what can you be thankful for, or maybe what are you grateful for? Is there anything that could kind of help the person to think, oh, that I'm alive, that I can even do, I can breathe? Mm-hmm. Things like that could help, you know, address questions.
So, like, what are you thankful for?
He feels out of control. What is in control? What happens when we're out of control? Who's running the show?
Yeah.
Start with the common point of, like, identity and meaning. That's something that's accessible even if you don't attest to faith.
Yeah.
If there's no life beyond this one, then why does he value writing so much?
For what he believes and for what his pride is in, what he finds pride in all that, does his soul still feel fulfilled? Or did it ever feel fulfilled?
Can you repeat some of those?
Oh, I'll try. So, was his soul, is his soul fulfilled? Like, if he finds purpose and meaning in that, does he feel... purpose and meaning in that. Repeat yours for me.
Oh, so, well, you said there's no life beyond this one. And if there's no life beyond this life, then why does he find so much value in writing in this life?
Right. So why does he find value in writing if there's no life beyond this one? I'll take one. Do one more.
I'm wondering about, like, his past experience and what caused him to, like, shift. And if there was, like, at one point, was he, like, super hopeful versus now?
Yeah. So we have a shift of, like, born Presbyterian to atheist. What caused that shift? All right. These are amazing questions, great ways to address it. Now, imagine for a second that you're his occupational therapist and you have 3.5 minutes left before you're supposed to go to your next patient. How would you address it? Nervous giggles around the room.
I can set a connection that would lead me to revisit that, or probably find a transition with another worker.
Okay. So maybe starting the conversation and coming back to it, or transitioning to somebody else.
How about asking him what would be helpful?
Asking him what would be helpful? Would he be willing to consider an alternative view in 3 minutes? Remember. So, because that's one of the concerns that I heard voiced here was the time. So it was our time and then the environment. So in 3 minutes, what's the next question you're asking? This will be the situation. We get those doorknob deep thoughts. We may or may not be able to come back. Is on that paradigm, that's the right word. Sure. That line that Bob shared, where is this patient falling? All right, someone say it clear. I hear the mumbles in the room. Not interested. So do we address it?
I think Jesus said, if you come to someone's house knocking and he doesn't want your services, dust your feet. I think it's part of spirituality.
Yeah. So we are, as people of faith, a lot of times we want to share the hope that we have. And we are so excited to share this hope. And so then we hold out our hope and they're like, no. No, thank you. So when I hear Joe, I hear, I'm an atheist. Yeah, I grew up with some of that stuff. But I found meaning. And it is broken. But we hear that meaning is broken right now. So we hear a little bit of where the Holy Spirit's working.
The earlier statement was it would be helpful to ask the question, would it be helpful for me to pray for you?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So before we switch over to looking at a little bit more of like the scientific and ethical side of this. So when we come to someone like Joe and we have limited time, we hear a brokenness, we hear a lament, and we want so badly to address it. But maybe he's not ready to address that yet. We can take one of two avenues. We can finish up what we're doing and we can pray for Joe. That's still holy work. That's still an avenue. That's still moving him one step closer to the kingdom. We can also, again, kind of that, would it be helpful for you? In 30 seconds, I can say, man, it sounds like all the things that you valued have taken a really big hit right now. And that would be hard for me. Is that hard for you? Like, has that changed how you see yourself? I heard you say that you grew up kind of with a faith background, but it doesn't sound like that's really something that you have right now. Like, has that changed at all? And you can leave it there. You can leave. He might answer those questions. He might go, no. He might answer a little bit deeper. But you're sensitively moving forward with what he's given you, not what you have necessarily. Does that make sense? You have all of this hope for him, and you want to hold it for him, but we're not shoving it to him. We're not saying, take it. I have all this hope for you. You need it. I hear you want it. You're saying, I have all this hope for you. Do you want it? So that's kind of what we're going to move forward in talking through this ethically, too. All right, science. We are all people of science. Let's talk about the science side of it. So what do studies tell us? Patients use religion to cope. It is one of the main coping mechanisms, whether that's praying, whether that's having a community of faith as support, whether it's just something that makes them feel good. Patients use religion to cope, and they would like their physicians to discuss religion and spiritual issues. Most studies, there's a positive correlation, especially heart disease, cancer, anything that's going to make you die. You know, they're like, please talk about it. So there was a major study on the significant relationship between religion and spirituality that was conducted in 2012. So for those interested, this article, and then there's another one. Oh, yours is attached to me too. In the Annals of Medicine as well, and it's on the slides. So positive correlation. Most studies show that there's a sense of well-being, hope, higher self-esteem, adaptation to bereavement, social support, and stability in marriage when associated with spiritual care done by physicians and nurses and other people in medicine. There's a negative correlation with loneliness, rates of depression, rates of suicide, anxiety, psychosis, all the things that we want to avoid. So this is the second article. This included 371 articles in this review study, and the inclusion criteria was serious illness. 76.9% had a low to moderate risk of bias. And so this is a good one as well to read on kind of the implications and what interventions are ranked highest in health outcomes. American Academy of Family Physicians, rates spiritual care as a C. for those of you who know what the ratings, so A is consistent evidence, B, inconsistent or limited, C is there's consensus, that it's beneficial. So let's talk about what patients believe and how patients interpret their providers bringing up spiritual things. So 79% think that it can help in their recovery. 56% thinks that it'll help them in that specific illness. And 63% of those polled thought that, yes, their physician should ask the patient about their spiritual beliefs. So in a study in patients with advanced cancer, 80% said that they thought that spiritual care was important and that their nurses and the physicians should address it. 79% said it didn't happen, though. So think about that. Why? Lack of training. So the strongest predictor for not providing spiritual care is, I was never taught how to do it. We are taught how to do a lot of things. Spiritual care is not usually one of them. However, more than half of the schools now require some sort of training in spiritual care. By a raise of hands, how many people during their school program learned how to do spiritual care? Yeah, that tracks. So more than half the schools require some sort of training. Unfortunately, some of that training is ask spiritual questions. Okay, you're trained. So a recent study, though, in 2004, said that 84 out of 126 medical schools offered courses on spirituality and medicine. A lot of times they are elective courses that aren't usually that well attended. And then Bob brought up some other programs where you can find some supplemental training as well. Because, again, a lot of times we don't do what we don't think we know how to do. All right, so prayers. 75% of Americans claim to pray regularly or believe in the healing power of prayer. 1.7 million patients said that So they surveyed 1.7 million patients in 33% of hospitals, and that one of the lowest clinical care indicators was their satisfaction with emotional and spiritual care. And it was one of the highest areas needing improvement. So for those of us working in secular hospitals who think, well, the patients here don't want this, that's what these last few slides are talking about. The patients want it, and they feel like it would improve their care, but they're not getting it because we don't feel trained to do it, or we don't feel comfortable doing it in that environment. Most of us could share the gospel with the greatest of clarity in a coffee shop, but the second we step in a patient room, we got no idea what we're doing. But that's the place where people want it most. So, patients who had discussions of religion and spiritual concerns are more likely to rate their care at the highest level, regardless on whether they say they wanted it discussed or not. So our other fear is, well, what if they don't want, what if that's not even on their mind? They're not even thinking about that. They're thinking about their broken toe. They are not worried about Jesus. But I said, if it's addressed, they are more likely to rate you as a fantastic nurse, even if you did something wrong, than if you hadn't addressed it. All right, surgical patients, 83% strongly agreed that the physician should be aware of their spirituality. 63% said that they should take a spiritual history. 64% indicated that they would trust their surgeon more if their surgeon actually asked those questions and took that into consideration. Outcomes, better outcomes. Summary of that slide. We got 15 minutes left, so I'm going to glaze over a few of them. So, Jesus said, I don't ask that you take them out of this world. I don't ask that you take them out of secular hospitals. I don't ask that you take them out of secular roles. I don't ask that you take them out of secular schools. I don't ask that you take them out of the clinics that they are in and move them to somewhere in remote Africa because that is the only place where they can freely talk about me. He said, I ask that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of this world, just as I am not of this world. Sanctify them in the truth, and as you have sent me, I send them. Jesus wasn't only sent to the people who would receive him. He wasn't only sent to the religious sinners and the places where they were already talking about it. He was sent everywhere. Same he sends us. He doesn't, again, he doesn't ask that we're taken out, but that we go in and that he is brought along with us in those places. So the majority of physicians agree that religion and spirituality is important for patients. 85% said that they should be aware of what the patient believes. Most of them aren't asking, but they think it's a good thing, and they should probably be aware of that. There's not a lot of negative studies. There are a couple of them. You can read through those. So current state of spirituality in medicine. By keeping patients' beliefs and spiritual needs separate, we are potentially ignoring an important element of the patient's care. That was in 2007, even more so now. Given the advances in this area over the past decades, physicians can no longer ignore the spiritual needs and aspects of care, nor are they able to ignore the spiritual aspects of delivering care. All right, I told you we were going to talk about those tenets and how it plays into ethics. So as we get into this, I want you to keep in mind two things. So one of the things I tell my pharmacy students is I want you to know the rules. I want you to know the ethical tenets. I want you to know what it looks like to ethically care for a patient apart from medicine. And I want you to know the rules for your hospital and for the area that you're working on the ability, your ability to practice spiritual care, to hand out spiritual information, to address spiritual needs with your patient. Why? Because I want you to know how to adhere to them, and more importantly, how to break them. So, because a lot of times our fear of the rules is that we don't know what they are, and so we don't know if we're breaking them, and we don't know how to give a defense. There is a specific reason why the Holy Spirit tells us, be ready to give a defense. He doesn't say, like, you're going to share this hope and just be ready to be happy. He says, be ready to give a defense for it. As soon as you do it, be ready to defend it. All right. So all of our ethical, these four tenets are addressed in each ethical code, whether you are a pharmacist, doctor, nurse, any of those things. So, so overall, spiritual people do better, decrease mortality in studies. So, non-maleficence. Do no harm. Patients use religion to cope. So, we already talked about kind of those positive correlations. So, if patients are using religion to cope, and if there's a positive correlation in their healthcare outcomes and their health, thank you, then doing no harm kind of follows along with that. Sorry, I got a little flustered at 10 minutes there. So, in extrinsic religion, increased stress and anxiety. So if it's just a socialized religion, it can increase their stress and anxiety. So we kind of want to assess, like, how, like, they have religion, but, like, is it something that they've internalized or something they just do? But if it's an intrinsic If it's an intrinsic religion, if it's something that they've internalized, if it's something that's changed their lives, decreased depression, increased forgiveness, there's positive psychological effects, and increased hope. So I'm going to skip over this just a little bit, just for time's sake. But in this main example, Jesus has compassion on them, and he doesn't send them away hungry. Again, over the vast majority of your patients want this, and we're sending them away hungry. And that is not the model of compassion that Jesus has set out for us. Autonomy. We could talk all day about autonomy. Deliberated self-rule. The patient has a right to make choices. Would it be helpful for you? Would you like to do this? We talk about informed consent in medicine. We have to have informed consent in spiritual care just as much as we do in chopping off their leg. So, as clinicians, we need to perform a spiritual assessment in order to assess the patient's worldview. What is their worldview? And it may, like, most of the time, sometimes it might be Christian, sometimes it might not be. But we need to know where it is so that we know where to start. We don't make assumptions. Where the gospel is assumed, it's usually absent. Same thing with other religious practices. Just because they don't say that they follow religion doesn't mean that some of those practices are not influencing the way that they see the world. All right. I'm going to spend a little bit more time on justice here at the end. So we have a moral obligation to be fair, impartial, and equitable, especially in regard to the distribution of health resources, respecting individuals' rights, and following legal laws. A lot of times when it comes to ethical spiritual care, our question is, how do I ethically perform spiritual care as a Christian to someone who's not? Correct? Yes? Okay. Here's the thing. Is it ethical for me to withhold the hope that I have if I know a better way of coping from a patient who doesn't share that same worldview? So that's where we meet justice here. Justice isn't, again, it's being fair. Is it fair to take away the choice of a patient to hear about this hope out of my fear? Is that just? Well, I don't know if you want to hear it, so I'm just not going to tell you. I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble, so you don't get to hear the gospel. And that example that Bob was talking about, where the man is clearly searching and seeking. And actually, let's go to the example he gave of Dr. Levy, where he's waiting. He's waiting to go in and talk to that patient. Well, these people are around, so I can't talk now. Well, this is happening, so I can't talk now. Like, is it just for that patient to withhold something that we think is beneficial for them? Does that respect their autonomy as well? So, Micah 6:8, he showed us what is good and what does the Lord require of us: to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. If we seek to uphold justice and autonomy, to do no harm and to do good, humbly walking with the Lord, like, we will be practicing ethically. All right. I'm going to skip over a couple more here. All right. So we began with the question, is spiritual care ethical? So we answered affirmatively. It's a net benefit. Patients want it. It shows to be beneficial to their care. Validates their autonomy by enabling deliberated decisions. It's just validating, honoring to the autonomy of each patient. But it has to be done skillfully, and it has to be done again, in accordance to what the patient wants. So we want to make sure that we're listening. So the main thing I can teach you in how to practice spiritual care and how to ethically practice spiritual care isn't, again, all the rules. Know them. Know how to break them. We'll get there in a little bit. But also learn how to listen to your patients. You don't necessarily have to ask spiritual questions to hear spiritual answers. Just like we talked about, that whole person care. Like, I can ask a question about, what do you do for fun? What do you do for work? What did you have for dinner? Even these questions that are a normal part of your assessment, a normal part of the things that you do every day, will have spiritual answers and spiritual implications if you're listening for them. So, again, know the rules, know how to break them. Well, why did you talk about the gospel with this patient? I didn't bring it up. I asked him what he did. I asked him what his occupation was. That is on the list of questions you gave me to ask. I was responding to his answer. So, as a pharmacist, one of the jobs that I've had is working at Costco. No one walks into Costco and is like, I'm going to talk about Jesus in here. Especially at the Costco pharmacy. They want a flu shot. They want to get their cheap drugs. They want to leave. So I'll give you an example of one of the patients that I had. So when you work at Costco, you're the only pharmacist. There ain't nobody else there. There's you and a technician. So you're trying to hurry up. Everything is at the speed of lightning, as I work for CVS as well. Okay, that's a whole, I don't even know what's faster than lightning, but there was that. and so working at Costco one day at the window, patient brings me a long list of things that he would like price checked. And I'm like, fantastic. This is going to be good because I have time for this, I said in my head. And so I take the list, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to take this list. You walk around. You shop. And can you give me about 15, 20 minutes, and I'll get these all priced out for you? He says yes. He leaves. He comes back. So I give him the list. He shares with me a little bit about these are his wife's medications, really trying to get them cheaper because they're trying to support their daughter. I'm like, okay, that's cool. So here's the price list. Here are the comparisons. And we're done. I got to go back to check 800 other things that I should have been doing while I was doing your price checks. And then he says, yeah, he's like, I'm taking care of my granddaughter right now, too, because his mother is just deep into drugs, and we don't know where she is, and it's just been really hard. And so, did I ask anything? Nope. But he gave me that. And in that moment, I recognized where the Holy Spirit was working. And so, in the middle of our little pass-through window at Costco, I'm like, that must be really heartbreaking. Would it be helpful for you if we prayed for your daughter? And so, with a line over here, my technician's running back and forth behind me. We prayed for his daughter, sitting there in the window. And, you know, we prayed, and I said, that's really hard. And that sounds like you really love her. And that it's really hard having her, not knowing where she is. And I'll continue to pray for her. And that was the end of our encounter. And again, I was responding to what the patient gave me. Wasn't against the rules to take that minute. It only took a minute. I got back to what I was doing. But when looking at the barrier of time, so we're going to address the barrier of time here. What does 5 minutes look like in the eternity of another person? Am I going to be running 5 minutes late? Am I now another 5 minutes behind? But what does that mean for the eternity of another? If we keep that perspective, it helps keep that time check, that speed, that I need to get things done or I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to take that time. It might affect this person's eternity. If you need another perspective on 5 minutes, actually, it's actually 30 minutes. But we'll pretend it's five, because who got 30 minutes? Nobody. Revelation. There's a point where the seals are opened, the wrath of God is poured out, and heaven for eternity is singing the praises of the Lord. But for 30 minutes, they are silent. They are horrified. They are broken. And they are grieving for humanity. The weight of eternity can silence even heaven, and it should slow us down for a few minutes. So, back to supervision, people around. The Bible has lots to say on what it looks like to be bold in front of people. Also, like, if we're practicing ethically, if we're responding to the needs of our patient, if we're doing it in a way that's respecting their autonomy, we are silencing the naysayers. So, because a lot of times those questions are, how could you do that? I'm responding to what they said, and they have a choice. Make sure that they have a choice. Make sure that you're responding to what they say. There's a lot of, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to wrap up here. There's a lot of in hospital rules about passing out religious information. So we go back to Nicole's example there. Know the rules. Know how to break them. Ain't no rules against paper and pen. Ain't no rules against a marker and your glove. Ain't no rules against a napkin or a tissue that's on the bedside and me drawing it out for the patient. So I didn't give them religious information. I drew a picture. It's not even a good picture. So, and sometimes, like, maybe know if they're allowed to keep that. Again, know the rules. Know how to break them. Know how to ethically utilize the rules to your advantage. I'll say it that way. We want to make sure that we understand our own spirituality. We're not going in with an agenda. It is unethical for you to go into a patient's room with the agenda of, I am going to practice spiritual care. Because that is all about you and nothing about them and nothing about Jesus. That is completely self-centered. So we're not going in with an agenda to check a box and to say, I practice spiritual care. We're going in with a hope that we can hear where the Holy Spirit is working and that we can meet him there. So we want to be making sure that we're discerning, and we want to be making sure that we're listening, not that we're trying to do something. Does that make sense? All right. Professional integrity, we're also not going in like, I am a preacher, when we're not. So we also, under professional integrity, do not let your desire to do spiritual care and to practice whole person care make you a bad nurse or doctor. So, God has created us to be whatever, insert profession here, but also Christian. We are Christians who happen to be physicians. We are Christians who happen to be doctors, or that's the same. pharmacists, counselors, whatever. This is first. This is second. This is also important. Because if you're a bad doctor, what does that say about the spiritual care that you're providing? So, provide good care in order that they might hear the spiritual care that you're providing as well. All right. It's also mandated by JCO. So again, you can kind of read through those slides. You can read through the quotes from JCO that says that you have to do a spiritual assessment. So while you're hiding your water bottles in the nurse's station, pretending that you're not shoving in a bite of food while you're walking or while you're talking to a patient, whatever, like, remember that you're supposed to do a spiritual assessment. So these are some examples of questions that JCO gives of what you could answer or what you could ask to the patient. Many benefits. Again, so these last slides, you're going to have to read through time. All right, so, and then we go back to Joe. One of the things, like we talked about, that we want to be listening for are red flags. How some spiritual beliefs can be detrimental to your patient. So some practices can be detrimental to your patient. So those things that we want to kind of address. For your patient's sake, not your spiritual ego, you want to try to correct those things. So, y'all okay if we go over a couple minutes? Okay. So I had a client a few weeks ago. We talked about she wanted to forgive. Okay, let me rephrase this. She wanted forgiveness from someone who she had threatened to stab, but she felt like she had good reasoning. And she had apologized, and she wanted the girl to hear her apology and forgive her too. And in that, like, this is just, she's just having a really hard time with this. She was drinking more, she was struggling, she was avoiding places, and so in that, I could hear a red flag. Your idea of forgiveness is broken, and we're going to address that right now. And so the way that I did that, I said, all right, so what are you doing to kind of move toward a place where this is better? And she said, well, I've been really praying about it, so I guess I can just really keep praying about it. I said, okay. You know, you said that you've been praying about it, and that's been helpful. And, you know, you've said that you've been reading the Bible more, and you're trying to grow. And I was like, can we look at some examples of what forgiveness looks like in Scripture? Would that be helpful? And she's like, yeah. And so we went through, and we talked about Jesus. And I'm like, all right, so when did Jesus forgive you? Well, on the cross, when he died. All right, so when was that? I was like, was that, like, last week when you sinned? Like, or she goes, when I sinned. And I was like, okay, so that was like last week, like yesterday, like, and she's like, no, it was a long time ago. And I was like, oh, well, had you apologized about like 2000 years ago? And she's like, well, obviously no. And I'm like, but you sound like you're waiting for this girl to forgive you and to say that she's sorry before you forgive her. And she's like, and I was like, is that the example that Jesus gave? No. And I'm like, he forgave you long before you were ever sorry, long before you ever realized you were wrong, long before your sin even existed. And I'm like, that's the kind of forgiveness he's calling us to. And I'm like, I'm not going to pretend that's going to be easy. And we're going to keep talking about it. But as you're praying and asking God to help you with this forgiveness, it might help if you have a frame of forgiveness of how he forgave you. Because he said, just like I did, you do likewise. And I was like, so maybe let that shape your prayers a little bit. I was like, was that helpful? Yeah, that helped. And again, you hear that respect for autonomy. You hear me giving her choices. Should we talk about this a little bit more? Can I talk about it in this way? All right, if a patient says no, no means no. We learned that in a lot of aspects. No means no. So that is not, that also applies to Jesus. No means no. All right, praying for patients is not a spiritual win. Praying for patients only if it's helpful and with their permission. Not praying for patients does not mean that you failed. It means that that's not where the Holy Spirit is working. So we're going to reframe your idea of success. Success is hearing where the Holy Spirit's working and meeting him there. So it's not this is not an excuse to not pray when the Spirit leads you. And if you're not spiritually attuned, refer to someone else. If you don't know what you're talking about, don't just like if you don't know how to treat something, you refer to someone who does. If you don't know how to answer a question, if you don't know how to address this stout Muslim who is deep in their practices and this is influencing their beliefs and you're like, I don't know what to say to that, refer to someone else. That is good spiritual care. Clinical competence requires skill. Spiritual competence requires awareness and surrender. So Jesus doesn't say, come to me and I will give you all the skills. He said, come to me and I'll give you myself. So what we need to practice good spiritual care is a good reliance on the Holy Spirit. Because apart from me, you can do nothing. All right. So we talked about lack of training being a reason that we don't do spiritual care. Lack of training can also be a reason that we do bad spiritual care because we are trained now. We have a thing that we do. We do the thing, and the thing is done. We don't want to let our training decrease our reliance on the Holy Spirit, decrease our reliance on being sensitive to where the Holy Spirit's working and how he wants us to respond. All right. So much more. All right, questions. Quickly, even though we're over time. We're going to pretend we're not.
Just a comment that no matter how much permission you'll get and how much openness and the rules and everything, more than likely somebody's going to complain and you're going to face persecution.
Yep. Persecution does not equal failure. Most of the time, like you said, if you're doing it right, there's still going to be people who are not happy about it. If Facebook and Instagram has taught us anything, whatever you say, someone has something else to say about it. So, any other questions as we close? Thank you guys for your time and your patience.